From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Federal Reserve has cut interest rates for the fifth time this year. The Fed's Open Market Committee announced another half-point reduction in rates as it seeks to prevent the economy from tumbling into recession. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
The Federal Reserve has now lowered short-term interest rate targets by a full 2.5 percentage points since the start of the year. The latest move by the Fed pushes the federal funds rate to 4%, its lowest level since April of 1994. Bert Ely is a monetary policy consultant.
The Fed is continuing to respond to the most recent news available to it, specifically the continuing drop in industrial output and also the very severe erosion in corporate profits in the first quarter of this year.
In a statement accompanying the announcement, Fed policymakers pointed to declining investment in capital equipment by business as well as uncertainty about the current business climate. The move by the Fed's Open Market Committee was largely anticipated by Wall Street, which showed little reaction to the rate cut. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
California regulators have approved a rate structure that will require consumers to pay up to 47% more for electricity. The rate hike will amount to a record $5 billion for California's two biggest utilities. The final rate structure contains changes that shift much of the burden of the increase to consumers while easing the boost for business and farm users. The changes came after heavy lobbying by powerful business groups such as the Silicon Valley Manufacturing Group, which represents some of California's biggest employers. The rates will affect about 9 million customers of Pacific Gas and Electric Company and Southern California Edison. Israeli soldiers have killed 4 Palestinians and wounded 120 after a day of mass rallies across the West Bank and Gaza. Palestinians were marking the anniversary of Israel's creation, a day they mourn. NPR's Jennifer Ludden is in Ramallah.
Palestinian officials issued an edict banning guns at the rallies, but a few young men defied the order, firing into the air. Afterward, hundreds marched to Israeli army checkpoints for routine confrontations with soldiers. Most threw rocks, a few gunmen opened fire. Israel's army also reported a number of attacks on Jewish settlements. It said one Israeli woman died after being shot in a West Bank road. More than 700,000 Palestinians were exiled when Israel declared its state in 1948. The anniversary, which Palestinians call a Nakba, or catastrophe, recalls their dispossession and renews pledges of their right to return. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Ramallah.
Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 4 points to close at 10,873 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 4 points to end the day at 2,085. This is NPR News. The Drug Enforcement Administration says it's investigating whether its office in Puerto Rico falsely claimed credit for drug arrests and seizures that were really the work of local police. The DEA in Washington was responding to a report in today's Miami Herald. The newspaper quoted a former supervisor at the San Juan office as saying that 70% of the arrests claimed by the office from 1998 to 2000 were faked. Two studies in this week's Journal of the American Medical Association connect breastfeeding with a lowered risk of obesity in children. NPR's Rachel Jones reports.
In the first study, NIH researchers focused on more than 2,700 3- to 5-year-olds. They measured the children's body mass index and asked their mothers if they had breastfed and for how long. Researchers did find a lower obesity risk for breastfed children, but only a slight one. In the second study, Harvard researchers asked more than 15,000 9- to 14-year-olds to report their heights and weights. Then their mothers told researchers about their breastfeeding practices. This study found a 20% reduction in obesity risk for adolescents who had been breastfed. An accompanying editorial states that though the two studies appear to differ, they both add to the list of numerous benefits of breastfeeding. Rachel Jones, NPR News, Washington.
A Florida jury has adjourned for the day without reaching a verdict in the case of Nathaniel Brazil, a 14-year-old who's accused of killing his middle school teacher last year. The jury must decide whether the shooting was accidental or deliberate. Brazil is being tried as an adult. In stocks today, the S&P 500 gained a half point to close at 1,249. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Archer Daniels Midland Company, maker of all-natural vitamin E, the nature of what's to come, on the web at admworld.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Memory is very imperfect, and those imperfections can drive you crazy, whether you've forgotten the name of someone you work with, forgotten where you put your keys, or can barely remember the details of a life-changing experience. My guest, Daniel Schachter, has spent about 20 years investigating how memory works. His new book is about how the mind forgets, remembers, and distorts the past, and what we're learning about that from new medical technology. He proposes that there are seven different types of memory malfunctions, which is why he titled his book The Seven Sins of Memory. Schachter is chair of Harvard's psychology department. Here's a typical memory problem. You leave home, then halfway down the street you wonder, did I lock the door? Did I turn off the coffee pot? I asked Daniel Schachter what it takes to make a memory of an everyday task.
One of the nice things about our cognitive system is that it allows us to do a lot of everyday tasks on automatic. However, memory very much requires attention and what psychologists call elaborative encoding in order to establish a memory of a new event. So you've got to attend to that event, related to things that you already know, in order to lay down the kind of information that you can later consciously retrieve. And if your mind is off somewhere else, you're not attending to the event, then you're not going to establish a memory that you can later retrieve.
So if you're, say, very busy and you're doing several things at once, are you less likely to remember things and more likely to be absent-minded?
Absolutely. That's probably the most or one of the most common sources of absent-mindedness, and it's been shown over and over again in laboratory studies that when you divide attention, you have people doing a number of things. One of those things is trying to learn a list of words or a series of pictures or whatever the experimenter shows them, that when you divide attention, you have a devastating effect on later memory.
Let's get to another problem of memory, which is transience, the fact that memories fade or become inaccurate over time. A good example that you give in your book is a research project that was conducted in California about how well people remembered where they were when the O.J. Simpson verdict came down. Would you describe the study?
Yeah, that was a very interesting study. What they did is they asked some university students several days after the verdict to write down their memories of how they had heard about the verdict, where they were, and so on and so forth, on the assumption that memories at this point after a couple days would be pretty accurate. The interesting part of the study occurred when they brought these students back later, about 15 months later, and now they asked them again, how did you hear about the verdict? And what they found is that only about half accurately recalled how they found out about the verdict. And when they brought them back again nearly 3 years later, less than a third of the students now accurately recalled what they remembered. So there was a dramatic fading of memory over time, and they even distorted their memories and started to remember details that were actually inaccurate.
Why do memories fade or become inaccurate over time?
There are probably a number of reasons. One has to do with interference. So we have many other experiences that may be similar in some ways, and we may so any individual experience may be harder to pull out because you're now trying to pull it out from a whole collection of similar experiences which may interfere with it in some ways. There may be some room for just passive decay or weakening of information over time. We know that memories are stored in neural connections, connections between neurons, and there's some evidence from studies of animals that those connections may spontaneously weaken over time. So it's probably not so much time itself, but what happens in the time interval. Now, another important thing to keep in mind about transience is that it differs in very interesting ways from absent-mindedness. They both are forms of forgetting, but people often confuse them. And I think that the confusion can sometimes lead people to worry, perhaps needlessly, about developing conditions such as Alzheimer's disease. In a condition like Alzheimer's disease, we see greatly accelerated transience. That is, patients have a great difficulty holding on to information, you know, for more than a few minutes. This can be a very dramatic kind of condition. It's nicely illustrated in the recent movie Memento, which you may have seen. Where there's the main character can't make new memories and hold on to them. That is very characteristic of a condition such as Alzheimer's disease. But people often get worried that they're developing this condition when, in fact, what they're suffering from is absent-mindedness, failures at the interface between attention and memory, and not this accelerated transience that really is a serious sign of decline.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about transience, about forgetting over the course of time the details of what happened or what happened to you. And that could be really disturbing when you don't even remember the story of your own life over time, you know. Are there ways of keeping those memories more alive without writing a journal? So that, I mean, that's one technique. You write a journal, you've got it recorded. Even if you don't remember, the book does. But short of doing a journal, is there a way of reinforcing an accurate memory in your mind so that it endures over time?
Yes. There are basically two ways to go after it. One is at the time of initial encoding, trying to elaborate on an experience as it's occurring, trying to link incoming information to things that we already know. Now, that's a lot of work for most of us to go around. We can't go around every minute of our lives trying to actively relate incoming information to things we already know, making up images, stories, and associations. But to the extent that we can, that will increase the durability of the memory over time and help to counter or fight off transience. The other thing that we can do that is kind of like a notebook, but without actually writing things down, is just bringing memories to mind frequently, particularly in the days or weeks after they occur. Those things we want to remember benefit greatly from rehearsal and repetition. And in fact, I think probably a major determinant, if not the major determinant, of the durability of a memory has to do with how often we think about and talk about the event later on. Those events that we tend not to talk about become increasingly less accessible. Those events that we do think and talk about become more accessible.
So talking with someone, with a friend or someone in your family over and over again about a significant event will really actually serve a function, which is to keep that event alive in an accurate way in your memory.
Absolutely, particularly if you start talking about the event soon after it occurs, when memory tends to be more accurate.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things we know, and it's nicely illustrated in that study of the O.J. Simpson trial, one of the things we know about memory and how it changes over time is that memory tends to be more literally accurate, more reproductive at soon after an event occurs. We have access to more of the details. Then as time passes, memory becomes more reconstructive. We lose the details, and we hold on to the general sense or gist of what happened. So if you want to rehearse and retrieve memories and keep them alive, you want to start pretty soon because those details rapidly become inaccessible.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schachter. He's chair of the psychology department at Harvard and author of several books about memory. His latest is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. Let's get to something I myself call proper noun disease, that you call proper name anomia. Anomia means without name. And this is basically where you know a person or you know the title of something, you just can't remember what that name is. And struggle, though you will, you can't remember the name. And it's not like you don't know it. You just can't get it. Describe that phenomenon a little bit more.
Well, this is what I call the sin of blocking, and it's the third of the forgetting-related sins, along with transience and absent-mindedness. And blocking occurs when information is available in memory, as you describe. We have a cue present, It may be a person's face or some description of that person. And we're doing our best to remember, we're paying attention, but we simply can't get to the information. We may feel as though it's on the tip of our tongue. We may remember all kinds of things about the person or place we're trying to remember, but we just can't get to the name. So blocking can be very frustrating. It's a very normal phenomenon, occurs to all of us, tends to increase with age. And we've learned a little bit about parts of the brain that are involved in this phenomenon in part by studying patients with brain damage. And there are certain patients who have selective difficulties in coming up with names of people and places. And many of these patients tend to have damage in a part of the brain known as the temporal lobe, kind of sits next to your ear. And up toward the front tip of the temporal lobe, these patients often have damage. So some of us believe that this part of the brain plays an important role in allowing us to retrieve specific information about the names of people and places.
Now, here's something that's very confusing about this phenomenon. Sometimes, even though you can't remember the name, you know it starts with the letter V, or you know, or you think you know there's three syllables. Or you'll be able to think of somebody else's name that has one of the same syllables as this person's name, but you still can't get to this person's name. What is that about?
Well, that is, you know, perhaps the most intriguing aspect of the blocking phenomenon, that so much partial information can be available. And although we don't fully understand it, our best guess is that the name itself is kind of stored separately from the different kinds of constituent information that go into that are related to it. So, for example, if I tell you that someone's name is John Baker, I'm not telling you anything about that person. If I tell you that someone is a baker, there's an immediate connection to all kinds of things that person does, where that person might work, and so forth. So proper names tend to be more isolated from other kinds of information. And this may be the reason why we're able to retrieve all these different kinds of information, but still not get to that proper name because it's kind of stored in an isolated manner.
The one of the disturbing things about this particular form of blockage is that sometimes you'll reach for a name, and not only, you know, aren't you coming up with it, but it's like you're looking into a void. You know, it's like you're looking for this name and there's nothing there. It's this big blank. And that's such a frustrating feeling.
It is. And one of the interesting things we've learned about this kind of name blocking is that the feeling you're describing becomes increasingly common as we get older. So when you look at tip-of-the-tongue states and name blocking in younger adults, let's say college students, the more typical finding is that you have access to all this partial information, as we were just discussing a minute ago. You may know the first couple of syllables. You may know various things about the person. But as you get older, it becomes more common for the blocking state to feel like just drawing a total blank and not having access to all this partial information. So that is one of the signatures of blocking as we tend to get older.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Daniel Schachter. He's the chair of the psychology department at Harvard University and the author of several books about memory. He's led many research experiments about memory. His new book is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. Let's take a short break here and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Daniel Schachter is my guest. He's the chair of the psychology department at Harvard and the author of several books about memory. His latest is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. Let's get to another fault of memory, which is suggestibility, that the mind is prone to suggestibility so that we might have a false memory or even make a false confession, basically remember something that never happened. Would you describe this phenomenon a little more?
Yeah, suggestibility occurs when, as a result of being probed, for example, with leading questions, we come to remember events that never occurred. It doesn't take all that much in order to implant a false memory through suggestion. One example I give in the book involves an airplane crash that took place outside of Amsterdam a number of years ago. It was a terrible crash in the suburbs. There was tremendous media coverage of it. It was a plane that crashed right into an apartment building, and it was left devastation in its wake. Several months after this happened, a group of Dutch psychologists asked people from their university community about what they remembered about this crash. And among the questions they asked was a very simple one. Did you see the television film of the moment the plane hit the apartment building? And over half the respondents to this question said yes. Then they did a follow-up study, and two-thirds of the people who were in that study responded yes. And these people were able to provide details about the speed and angle of the plane when it crashed into the apartment building, whether it was on fire before it actually hit the building, what happened to the plane after it hit the building, and so on and so forth. Now, what's interesting about this is that there wasn't any television film of the moment when the plane hit the building. Now, they may well have remembered some news footage of what happened after the crash and sort of grabbed onto that information and built around it and built this memory of an event that never occurred. Now, this is particularly important suggestibility because it has ramifications in the legal context. When law enforcement agents, for example, have a hunch about who a suspect in a crime might be or where a crime may have occurred, if they ask leading questions, you may come up with the same kinds of memories that these Dutch researchers came up with in their study of the airline crash.
Sometimes there are things that we really want to forget. Traumatic events, negative memories, stupid things that we did. And often those are the things that really stick with us and keep coming back whether we want them to or not. As a psychologist who specializes in memory, do you think that there might be something adaptive or beneficial about our inability to forget things that we want to forget?
Absolutely. I think this might be the clearest example of the adaptive value of these memory sins. One example I give in the book of how overwhelming the persistence of memory can be comes from the baseball pitcher Donnie Moore, who pitched for the California Angels back in the 1980s. And in the sixth game of the 1986 American League playoff series against the Boston Red Sox, the Angels were on the verge of winning the pennant. There were two out in the bottom of the ninth inning. They were up by a run. Donnie Moore was pitching. There was a batter, Dave Henderson, up for the Red Sox. He had two strikes on him. The crowd was up cheering in California, thinking they were about to win the pennant. Moore's teammates were up in the dugout dancing around. Two outs, looked like he had him struck out. Moore throws the next pitch. Henderson hits it out of the ballpark. The Red Sox win the game and go on to the World Series. Donnie Moore became haunted by that memory. His life became taken over by that awful memory of what he had done, eventually leading to depression, divorce, and at the end, suicide. Now, while there must be more than just that single memory to account for all that happened to him, it's an example of how extremely disabling the persistence of memory can be. His teammates, when interviewed years later at the time of his suicide, said his memory for that pitch killed him. And yet, if we think about this kind of persisting memory for a traumatic event. It's a feature that we want in our memory systems. We want our memories to hold on to threatening events that could threaten our survival. So it may be one of the most adaptive features of memory that, in fact, we have special machinery that is devoted precisely to storing these emotionally arousing events in a way that will persist over time. But the cost of that, the cost that we pay, is the disabling sin of persistence.
Daniel Schachter, thank you so much for talking with us about memory.
My pleasure.
Daniel Schachter is chair of Harvard's psychology department. His new book is called The Seven Sins of Memory, How the Mind Forgets and Remembers. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Remember the night you said, I love you. Remember you vowed by all the stars above you. Remember, remember we found a lonely spot, and after I learned to care a lot, you promised that you'd.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Holland America, offering cruises to destinations worldwide, including the Caribbean, the Panama Canal, Alaska, and Europe. On the web at hollandamerica.com. And from Random House Incorporated's Bantam Books Division, publisher of Aging with Grace, What the Nun Study Teaches Us About Leading Longer, Healthier, and More Meaningful Lives by David Snowden, Ph.D. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, reporting from a country where the phones and roads had fallen apart, civil servants were left unpaid, and the rule of law was virtually non-existent. We talk with Michaela Wrong about her new book, In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Journalist Michaela Wrong has witnessed what happens under a dictatorship when the rule of law falls apart and anarchy and absurdity take over. That's what she found in the Congo. She says that under the rule of Mobutu Sese Seko, it became a paradigm of all that was wrong in post-colonial Africa. She's been reporting from there on and off since 1994, when the country was still known as Zaire. The Congo is still in chaos. Mobutu was overthrown in 1997 by Laurent Kabila. Kabila was assassinated early this year and replaced by his son Joseph. Michaela Wrong now writes for the Financial Times and has also reported for Reuters and the BBC. Her new book is called In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. She told me some of the things that had gone wrong under Mobutu.
Well, I think the obvious things are that corruption was absolutely rife. I mean, it was a byword for sleaze, the whole country. And then you have a sort of non-functioning state system in which civil servants sort of receive $8 a month for their salaries or don't get paid at all. Then you have an army which is preying upon the public instead of protecting them. It's the one force that everyone is terrified of is their own army. They think they're going to go berserk. They hold people up at roadblocks. And then you have a sort of an economic system that's just sort of collapsed and a place where private companies don't want to go and invest. People don't have decent health services or education. Those are all the elements that I sort of think of as a typical failing state in Africa, and they were very much present in Congo Zaire.
You say that no other president had plundered his economy as effectively or lived the high life to such excess. You credit Mobutu with being the inventor of modern kleptocracy. What was his approach to plundering his own economy?
Well, I think sort of Mobutu's approach to the economy was essentially the approach of a sort of child in the sweet shop, where he just took and took and took, but he didn't understand, and this was something that none of his officials seemed to understand either, that something like a copper industry will not continue to function unless you invest in it and you train people and you get new equipment and you spend a bit of money. So if you just take and take and take, in the end, it just collapses. And of course, in Mobutu's case, there was this element of extraordinary greed, where the proceeds of the copper industry and the diamond mining industry, they were just going straight into his private bank account.
In 1994, when you first went to Zaire, which was later renamed the Congo, the government and the infrastructure had already collapsed, and people were virtually living in anarchy. The health care system, the education system, Social Security, the post office, rule of law had all virtually collapsed. And you say that when the infrastructure gave out, systems were put in place, some of which only the rich could use, like a new telephone system. Would you describe that new telephone system? This will give us a sense of what it was like.
Yes, I mean, I think now we're so used to mobile phones, but when I went out in 94, certainly in Britain, nobody was using them, and most European countries certainly weren't either. And I was astonished to see that there was this extremely effective, very efficient system of mobile phones in Kinshasa being used by the elite. It was called Telecel, and it had been set up by an American who had realised that basically nobody could communicate with each other because the state system had crumbled away. It had been installed by the Belgians, never maintained, the landlines were corroding, and they were also being cannibalised by people who had sort of cut up the wire and sell it. So he had set up this mobile phone system. And I always thought it was very, it was a real insight into Zaire, because if you could afford to, you could buy your way out of chaos. So, you know, the roads were falling apart. So people had four-wheel drive. The water was contaminated. You drink mineral water. I mean, there was always this sort of sense that there was a class of hugely rich people who could just, you know, sidestep the whole thing.
Did you ever meet President Mobutu when he was alive?
I never had a sort of one-on-one interview, but I was sort of around. You know, I sort of followed him on walkabout around the airport, and sort of, you know, he was sort of with his cane, which was supposed to be a magic cane, and he was lifting it above his head and walking around with his wife, walking around the airport, and then holding press conferences. But by the time I got there, he'd become almost a recluse. I mean, he spent very little time in the capital. He was up in the jungle estate he had, the Palace of Badalita, which was a good 2 hours flight away. So he was a difficult man to get to see. He was afraid. He thought he'd be assassinated if he spent too much time in Kinshasa.
Mobutu often looked really kind of ridiculous in photos. Would you describe his look?
Well, I mean, he never really got over the 1970s. He had invented this jacket called the Abacost, which it stood for Abba le costume, as in down with the suit, because it was supposed to be a revolt against Western sort of colonialization. And he was very fond of that jacket. And he, although it used to be obligatory for all Zaireans to wear it, and then he sort of dropped when they introduced multi-party democracy. But he sort of liked to wear it anyway. So he did look like somebody from the 1970s who'd been transported to the 1990s, definitely.
And didn't he sometimes wear like a pillbox hat?
Oh, yes. I mean, there was always that. I think if you look at African dictators, they always have a sort of symbol that they like to attach themselves to that makes them instantly recognisable. It's as though they don't have the self-confidence to really believe in the power they have. They have to have a symbol of their power to show around that this is me, you know, that I am the king. And with him, you know, there were the heavy sunglasses, the heavy black-rimmed glasses, the pillbox leopard skin hat, and the cane. Those were the key three items.
Was President Mobutu popular in the Congo? He had stolen his country's riches. He had created anarchy in throughout the country. Did people like him?
Well, I think he went through an extraordinary sort of rise and fall in popularity. By the time I got there, he was loathed, and he was regarded almost, I mean, it was a sort of, he had a satanic type of stature. I mean, anything that went wrong, anything that any sort of appalling event that happened, it was Mobutu was behind it. Even if you couldn't really see a link, then everybody blamed it on him. And I think the diplomats had a bit of the same tendency. I mean, he was regarded as this sort of evil genius behind everything. But if you go back and you find out and you talk to people about the 1960s, he took power twice. 1960, he then handed over to a civilian government. 1965, he came and he was there to stay. And really, he was enormously popular because they had had a series of disastrous years in which they had civilian politicians who'd been scratching each other's eyes out. They'd been a state, the army had mutinied. There was a sense that the country, there'd been secession attempts. The country seemed to be falling apart. Then there was this young guy who was simple, who was forceful, who was brave, who brought the army under control. He was enormously popular. They were very grateful for him taking over. And he maintained that for quite a long time. He was a very gifted public speaker. I've spoken to Zairians who went and listened to his speeches, and they said, you know, rather in the way that Hitler used to kind of charm his audience, only Mobutu did it with humour. He would crack jokes. He was very clever using the local Lingala language. He would sort of humiliate ministers that were unpopular already in public. He'd get them on stage and sort of make fun of them. And he would seduce the crowd. And that effect really did last for a very, very long time until the economy started to go into recession and he became afraid of his own population.
What part did America play in putting Mobutu in power and keeping him there?
Well, Mobutu had been talent spotted very early on in Brussels when he'd been there with Patrice Lumumba, who was the prime minister of the time. And the CIA had spotted him and thought, this guy is really promising. And Patrice Lumumba was sort of flirting with the Soviet Union, showed rather worrying communist tendencies. So they had sort of decided that Mobutu was their man. And definitely there was more than a nod and the wink and that he was getting sort of financial help from various embassies during those years when he was just head of the army. But really, I think the US's role in keeping Mobutu in power was it stretched over decades rather than just those years after independence because they were always there to hold his hand. He was taking tea at the White House. They were sending money through Zaire into Angola, so they needed Mobutu as a friend. So there was the funding going through. Then there was the US influence on the World Bank and the IMF. They made sure that both institutions kept lending to Mobutu. He had an incredibly powerful friend there, a friend who made sure that Western troops would be sent in when it looked like that there were going to be secession attempts on Zaire. So it stretched on really for decades.
My guest is journalist Michaela Wrong. We'll talk more about the Congo after a break. This is Fresh Air. Michaela Wrong is my guest. She's a journalist whose new book is called In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo, and she's been covering the Congo off and on since 1994. How was Mobutu overthrown?
Well, it's a long story, but essentially there was a rebel movement propped up by Rwanda and Uganda in the east that rose up and marched on all the way to Kinshasa. And what was sort of amazing was that people like myself, journalists and diplomats, were saying, well, you know, they say they're going to march on Kinshasa, they'll never get there. You know, have you seen the distances? Have you seen the state of the roads? And frankly, you know, there is still an army in Zaire which will stop them. And what happened was that the Zairean army sort of evaporated. They just never fought a battle. All they did was they retreated and they would rape and loot the villages as they went back. And the whole sort of army imploded. And the rebels just marched into Kinshasa. I was there when that happened, and everybody had been expecting an absolute bloodletting. And in fact, it was very peaceful because at the last moment, Mobutu's presidential guards, who everyone had expected to make a sort of massive last stand in Kinshasa, they just changed into tracksuits, got rid of their uniforms, and took the boat out of Kinshasa to Brazzaville. And so the city was largely won without almost a shot being fired.
Where were you when Mobutu was overthrown?
Well, I was in a hotel with a lot of other journalists in Kinshasa watching these presidential guards, because it turned out that the hotel we were staying in, the Intercontinental, we hadn't realized it. We decided to go there because we thought it would be the safest place to be, so that we could, because it's right next to the river. So we thought we would be able to run to the embassies, which were on the riverbank. And we knew that they had high-powered boats and that we'd be able to get out if necessary, if things really turned nasty. And what we discovered on the day that the rebels marched in was that, in fact, Mobutu's presidential guards had all been staying in our hotel, or at least they'd been putting up their families there, and therefore they were using it as a rallying point. And so there was a rather sort of unpleasant couple of hours where we were looking out of the window and seeing all these men with Kalashnikovs and sort of rounds and rounds of cartridges draped around their shoulders, and wondering if they were going to make a last stand in our hotel, and that we'd in fact picked the worst possible place to be in the capital. But what happened, as I said, was that they went through instead. They had it all planned. They weren't going to fight. They didn't think it was worth it. And they just changed into tracksuits, so none of them suddenly... They went from being, you know, military men to being civilians, and they took their families, their wives and their children and their luggage, and just walked to the river, got in boats, and got out of there, and that was it.
What's it like to stay in one place to cover a story like that, when I think the natural impulse would be to flee?
Well, I think the trouble is, I at the time, I was working for the Financial Times newspaper, and they were saying, we would like you to leave. And without sort of staging a massive showdown about it, I was saying, I really don't want to go. And I think that you're so intellectually curious to know the end of the story. You know, you feel that you've seen something of what was there at the start. You want to see it through. You just don't want to miss that. So in the end, it's much harder to tear yourself away. And I'm so grateful that I didn't leave then, because I just wanted to be there.
Was that a frightening time when people were running around drunk and looting? Did you feel in danger covering that?
Well, I think there was a sense that there were a couple of hours where the whole thing could have got completely out of control. But what happened was that what we understand happened was that the embassies, the Western embassies, who were in touch with Kabila, who was the head of the rebel movement, actually sort of phoned him and said, get a move on, get into Kinshasa fast. Mobutu has left. He's taken the plane to Badalite. You've got to get in there fast. And they were saying, but our forces are completely exhausted. And they said, well, you know, please speed it up, because they were still walking. And I think the most dangerous point in a city is when you have one, power is moving out, and another power hasn't yet come in. And it only lasted a couple of hours. So the looting began, but it was stopped pretty soon.
And what changed when Laurent Kabila took over?
Well, essentially, this is what's so depressing, because I think Kabila ended up making Mobutu look very good, because he wasn't capable of changing the system. He wasn't capable of relaunching the economy, which was desperately needed. And then he ended up having a second rebel uprising against him, organized also by Rwanda and Uganda behind these rebel movements. So essentially very, very soon he was in even more desperate straits than Mobutu, with half of his country out of his out of control, half of the country being held by these various rebel movements. And he was bartering off and selling off all sorts of state assets, resources, mineral resources to Zimbabwe, Angola and Namibia. So Kabila made Mobutu look good, which at the time we didn't think was possible.
Laurent Kabila was assassinated at the beginning of this year. His son took over. Is anything different now?
Well, I get the impression that everyone is hoping that what Laurent Kabila didn't achieve, you know, Joseph Kabila can begin to do more seriously. And the priority, obviously, is to stop the civil war. But I'm a little wary. I think it's not clear to me that he can deliver. He's under 30 years old. He's completely dependent on Angolan and Zimbabwean forces to stay in power. And I don't think the corrupt figures that were behind Laurent Kabila, his father, have gone away. So they're going to be wanting to stay in Kinshasa, make a lot of money from the mineral resources, and they haven't disappeared. So I'm very dubious about this whole new regime.
What's the state of the civil war now in the Congo?
Well, that's a very good question. With Joseph Kabila coming into power, there's been a new sort of impetus for peace. It's been very much encouraged by the US and Belgium and Germany, Britain are all sort of saying, let's really sit down, let's get this Lusaka peace process, which had been suspended under Laurent Kabila, let's get it so that it's effective. And we have had some troops being pulled back. Uganda in particular has been pulling back troops. So I think there is hope, but I'm a little worried that the hope is not going to be fulfilled.
I think there's a big debate that continues to go on about how much of Africa's problems in the states in which there are great problems can be attributed to colonial rule and how much of the responsibility African leaders have to take on themselves and African people have to take on themselves. The Congo is an interesting place because of the rule of King Leopold of Belgium, a very kind of corrupt and terrorizing rule. Tell us a little bit about his rule in the colonial era.
Well, yes, I think if you look at Congo's history, it's been brutalized time and time again. And I used to find, you know, that when I got there, I used to be so exasperated by the sort of what seemed to be the political passivity, which was the political passivity of the local people. And then, you know, when I was researching the book, it was really the moment where I began to think, my God, you know, I'm amazed that they're even as gumptious and as enterprising as they are, because you'd had slavery, and you must never forget. I mean, Central Africa was devastated by that experience of the slave traders from Eastern Africa, and then in the wake of that, very soon after that, you had King Leopold's rule, which was probably the most brutal rule on the African continent. I mean, he was after rubber because the pneumatic tire was about to become the great Western product, and there was wild rubber in abundance in Congo, and he wanted it, and he used the most brutal techniques to get it out of Congo. The sort of famous pictures that came back after a couple of years were pictures of people, baskets full of severed hands, and these were the hands of villagers, because Leopold's mercenaries would just go in there, and if a village hadn't come up with its rubber quota, then the young men would have their hands chopped off, and they would be taken back, and they would show these to the Belgian officials to show that they had done their job properly. And it's absolutely, if you think of that sort of taking place year in, year out, there were millions of orphans being created, the areas of Congo that were being burnt down and just sort of razed to the ground by these mercenary troops that he had recruited. It's absolutely devastating. And I think you can never forget that when you wonder why you know, Congo Zaire is the way it is today. That just left such a deep imprint on people's collective memories.
Well, Michaela Wrong, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Michaela Wrong is the author of the new book, In the Footsteps of Mr. Kurtz, Living on the Brink of Disaster in Mobutu's Congo. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg, literally. This is Fresh Air. She literally bit my head off. That's the kind of sentence that has language critics figuratively climbing the wall. But our linguist Jeff Nunberg isn't sure what all the fuss is about.
Sometime around the beginning of the 18th century, people started to use the adverb literally to indicate that they intended their words in the strict literal sense, as in after 6 weeks of fasting, he was literally dying of hunger. And as best I can figure, it was no more than a week after that that somebody had the idea of using the word in a figurative way, as in, she literally bit my head off. Writers have been stretching literally ever since then. Thackeray wrote, I literally blazed with wit, and Dickens described a character in Nicholas Nickleby as literally feasting his eyes. And in later years, the list grew to include Joyce, Fitzgerald, and Nabokov, not to mention Jean Stafford, who wrote at one point that her cat had started having literally millions of kittens. But despite those illustrious antecedents, that loose use of literally has come in for a hard time from the language critics. Intolerable, an assault on the language, a false coin that makes honest traffic in words impossible. Those are surprisingly vehement condemnations for what is at worst a pretty minor infraction. Granted, the use of literally can have inadvertently comic effects when a football announcer says they literally hammered the quarterback into the ground. That's the kind of sentence that the old New Yorker liked to run as a newsbreak at the bottom of the page. But where's the harm in it? After all, if I'm starving is an exaggeration, then I'm literally starving is just a bigger exaggeration. What would the critics want you to say? I'm figuratively starving? Where would be the fun if every exaggeration had to wear a warning stripe on its sleeve? When you think about it, the objection to the loose use of literally is very odd. It amounts to saying that literally is the only word in the English language that you're never allowed to use in a figurative way. But then, language critics themselves have always been an innocently literal-minded lot, the kind of people who believe that you can draw a neat line between literal and figurative meaning and stick scrupulously to one side of it. That notion has a powerful appeal in American life, and not just as it touches grammar. That came home to me when I was reading a recent book by the anthropologist Vincent Crapanzano called Serving the Word, which is a look at the American affinity for literalism in all its forms, from the pulpit to the bench. There may be differences between religious fundamentalists and legal textualists, but they both start with a faith in literal meaning, a kind of inland waterway where you can steer your words at a safe remove from the squalls of metaphor. That illusion of safe passage probably has a lot to do with another 18th century invention, the dictionary. When you run your eyes down those neat columns of entries, it's easy to think you can pull the meanings of words out of context and range them in clear glass boxes. But lexicographers know better than anybody else that it's all smoke and mirrors. In his preface to the first great English dictionary, Samuel Johnson wrote that the meanings of words can no more be ascertained in a dictionary than a grove in the agitation of a storm can accurately be delineated from its picture in the water. That's the problem I have with the critics who get down on people for using literally wrong. I have trouble knowing when it's being used right. As soon as you try to pin literal meaning down, you realize how spectral it is. Language is shot through with figures of speech, most of them so pedestrian and run-of-the-mill that they pass us right by. That's all that literal-minded means in the end. You can't hear the metaphors coming out of your mouth. Still, literal meaning is one of the grand illusions that makes modern life possible. The other day I spent a half hour on the phone with United Airlines having an animated conversation about the meaning of the phrase 7 day, and I realized that when it suits my purpose, I can be as much of a literalist as Jerry Falwell or Antonin Scalia. There are no relativists on a waiting list.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, just before the season finale of The West Wing, we talk with Brad Whitford, who plays Josh Lyman, the deputy chief of staff. Also, film critic Henry Sheehan calls us from the Cannes Film Festival. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.